This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And I got to ask you something. Are you looking for your next investment opportunity? Of course you are. Well, Interactive Brokers Global Analyst Tool helps you uncover hidden opportunities in the global stock market. Whether you do unique features like the World Data Screener, you can precisely pinpoint undervalued stocks by comparing and looking at prices and financial metrics of global stocks, all in the same currency. Plus, with the World Map Screener, it allows you to quickly find stocks that meet your specific financial criteria across the universe of global equities. Imagine the advantage of making better investment decisions and powerful tools that help you right at your fingertips. Don't miss out on the next great investment. Interactive Brokers clients in over 200 countries and territories trade stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, funds, and more on 150 global markets from a single unified platform. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Experience the power of IBKR Global Analyst for free today at IBKR.com/global analyst. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Trump campaign is picking up steam. Not all market sectors are really happy. Banks, small caps lead the way in an epic rotation over the recent weeks. Tech earnings coming out. Well, what's going to see what happens? We have a recent soft patch making me less nervous about reactions. And our guest this episode is Brad Baldridge, college planning expert. All this and much more on episode number 878 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Oh, did you feel that? It was like the earth was moving, like a groundswell of enthusiasm towards banks and small caps, something we haven't seen in a long time. And that's really interesting when we see that this rally that we've been having is starting to rotate, but yet at the same time, broaden out. In fact, earlier in the week when we saw that massive sell-off of tech, that first day of the sell-off of tech, it was pretty amazing that the Dow Jones was up. Now, mind you, a lot of that was due to UnitedHealthcare, and UnitedHealthcare was really doing what they can to hold that up with every point on the Dow equal to about 6.5 or 7. I mean, every point of the stock moving was 6.5 to 7 points on the Dow. So I calculated that over the 3 days that UNH was up, it was about 550 points of the Dow Jones Industrial moving because of it. Pretty interesting, right? But this excitement, this renewed enthusiasm towards banks and small caps, really interesting. It goes to also show you something that I think is really important, and that is the power of diversification. We're going to get to that. By way of intro, I'm Andrew Horowitz. That's my name. Hope you're having a great summer and I hope you're having the greatest summer of your life. This is one of those summers that I think a lot of people and a lot of people I'm talking to have said, you know, it's a great summer. I'm traveling, a lot of things that I put off for a while. And I think there's also still not revenge travel, but it's still the idea that FOMO and YOLO are kind of aligned, working together to make sure that you and I are doing what we can to get out there and realizing that it's not all about just the drudgery of the day-to-day situation and what we do. Well, with that, let's talk about the small caps. Let's get back to that. Talk about this interesting move of, what? 11% over 5 or 6 days? And some are calling for more. In fact, Tom Lee, who is the guy that you see on CNBC all the time, who gives you these outlandish predictions, some of them come true eventually, some of them don't. But what did he say? Something like 40% more upside opportunity in the small caps over the next 12 weeks, which would take us right into, where are we, July? Let's see, August, September, October. Yeah, that would take us into pretty much right to the election. So I think what his call is that he is making is that the hope that the election is going to provide small caps and banks a lot of opportunity. And I would think that he's believing that Trump and Vance, and by the way, you know why he chose, you know what former President Trump chose Vance? It was financial. It was all about saving money on the signs. The old signs that said Trump and Pence, all they had to do is change two letters, P-E to V to V-A. And there you go. You got Trump Pence to Trump Vance. But nonetheless, he's believing that if, in fact, Trump does get elected, and it does look like every day another thing is going on that makes it more likely for that to happen, that there'll be less regulation and a better market environment for banks to operate, and therefore this is going to help them. In addition, it's going to help with the drill, baby, drill, the potential for energy companies to do well. And with that, you'll see the energy companies. And a big component of the small cap universe is energy-related companies and banks. The regional banks, many of them, the sub-regional banks, and there's lots of them, and the financials in general, as well as the energy-related companies, whether it's the drillers or the producers or frackers, whatever it may be. All right, let's talk about the other fact that we saw that was recently beneficial for the small caps, and that was the yield curve steepening. That probably had a lot more to do with anything. We saw the yields on the 10-year start to come down, and of course the 30 stayed up, and the yield curve got back to, not back, but more normalized, or less abnormalized. That's a better way to look at it. And that is something that really does, in fact, again, look to help the banks. As we see that the yield curve starts to steepen, the opportunity for banks to make more on their net interest margin, in other words, their profitability goes up. And we saw last week and the week before the majors and a lot of the smaller players reporting, wow, there was great reaction to that. All-time highs on a bunch of the names, other names just popping up and holding up, whether it was Goldman Sachs or Bank of America, all doing very well. A few outliers there, but again, once again, better than anticipated, better than feared. So that's good. That's a good thing. So, when we look at the opportunity moving forward, whether or not it's going to be a 40% run or not, I think that you have to think about, well, were you allocated all to the small caps if you have an allocated portfolio and a diversified portfolio or not? And if not, why? One of the best performers this month to date is real estate. Who would have thought that, right? Real estate was dead and gone. But the fact is that this is one of the reasons why we hold certain things in our portfolio, sometimes less, sometimes more. It all depends on valuations and opportunity and outlook, but why we hold small cap positions in our portfolio, while we have a smattering of real estate in our portfolio. All these things are really beneficial when you see that kind of return. When you see the builders flying off the handle, which I called a bit wrong on that one, got out early so I didn't get hurt on it. But the fact is that when you look at what's going on with regard to the yield curve, the rates, the inflation rates, which it does see that inflation is cooling, and that's helping. So we got these numbers, these big numbers, a bigger reaction, bigger rotation. Talked about this on DH Unplugged last week, where a lot of money is coming out of these massive mega caps. And you just take a little bit out and then reallocate it to, let's say, small caps. There's a lot of money going into the small caps. So it's almost like if you think about those people that during the pandemic and after moved from, let's say, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, wanted to move down to Florida, Tennessee, maybe even Texas, and looked at the price and said, let me get this straight. I sold a house for $2 million. I could buy the same price house down, same size house down here for $800,000. Bid it up. I'll take it. So there's a lot of money coming out of an area, the overvaluation going into something that was fairly valued in there or even undervalued, dare I say, and then that's what happened. So pretty interesting stuff going on there with regard to this rotation, the money flooding in from the large caps into the small caps and into the financials and into the underperforming and better valuation opportunities and those areas that really look like, which a lot of investors in the institutional area love, this commentary of reversion to the mean. Mean reversion investing, whoever you want to say it. Mean reversion, meaning let's get to the longer-term averages. If the small caps have been underperforming for a long time and there's a significant differential, the distance between the performance and valuation of the small caps to the large caps, let's say, have been historically wide. And maybe it's time that that starts to shrink back to the long-term mean, the long-term average. So there is that mean reversion. We went well against the mean. So what will happen? What will happen is one of two things. One is going to be the small caps catch up dramatically and really go crazy on the upside to make that. Or the large caps come down a little bit. Or then a third option, both come in a bit. You know, both start moving a bit. We don't have to have a giant 40% move or a 40% crash. It could be simply that the large caps start to come in and the small caps start to come up. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, complicated. With that, let's get to our guest today because I want to talk about this. This is a kind of an off-investment topic, but still of interest to a lot of people, a lot of parents, a lot of grandparents, when we're talking about the idea of college education. And our guest today is Brad Baldridge. He's a college funding specialist who's helped thousands of families plan and save for college. And he's been a financial expert and blogger and host of the Taming the High Cost of College podcast and been doing this for over two decades. And he teaches parents the best ways to save and pay for college, including how to fix and find the right school, Brad, maximize financial aid and scholarships and avoid student loan debt and all that. So, Brad, it's been a long time since we had you on. I really appreciate you coming here and giving us some of the inside scoop on what's going on in the how to save for college area.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
So let's stop for a second. Because I always, you know, we've many times I talk to people and it's like we get right into the detail of what's going on. How did you actually get interested in and why did you get involved in the whole area of college planning?
Yeah, so I've been a financial advisor since the 90s. And as college became a bigger piece of the puzzle, I started talking about it more and I realized that there was it was a stress point for a lot of families. And as the prices kept going up, it became more stressful. And I realized that there was a lot of strategies and tactics that people could use. They just really weren't aware of what was going on. So I got more and more formalized in what I was understanding and what I was doing. And the more I dug into it and the more I talked about it, the more people listened. So it just kind of evolved into a specialty of mine. I still do, you know, general financial planning as well. But most of the families I'm working with now, it starts with some sort of college problem, typically what I would call late stage planning, which is you've got kids in high school and you're trying to figure it all out. And then for most families, it's, you know, we've got college for the next 5 or 10 years, and then we've got a couple of years off, and then we're going to want to retire.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, we've got college and retirement happening at the same time.
I mean, let's be honest. This stuff is sneaky. It sneaks up on you, right? You know, you start out in your 20s. You're like, okay, let me just get my house in order. Let's pay off some debt. Let's just get things rolling. Let's get some consistency. Let's just make some money. Let's maybe get a house, right? Then somewhere along the way, those kids come. Right. Magically. And then you're like, okay, let's figure out how to pay for these kids now, like today. And then, oh, by the way, you know, I realize that my entire retirement is on my shoulders. And I know that's 40 years out from here, 50 years out from here, but I think I got to start doing something. And then somewhere in between, it's like, well, what about those school costs? What about the camp? What about the weddings, the bar mitzvahs, the blah, 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 you know, all that stuff that comes in. And then all of a sudden you wake up one day and you're like, holy crap. They got to go college. And then that's the late stage you're talking about, right?
Right. Absolutely. Right. So and a lot of times people, you know, in the back of their mind, they think, well, you know, daycare is expensive. We got young kids. We'll deal with college later when kids get less expensive. And of course, those of us that have older kids. Right. Exactly. That's a joke. Right. It's like, yeah, daycare is expensive. But as soon as daycare goes away, we replace it with some other expenses typically. So kids never really get all that much cheaper. And the reality of it is most families did not save, you know, big piles of money for college. They might've saved some, but usually when we start digging into it, you know, in the high school years, most families are realizing that either they didn't save enough or they didn't save, you know, hardly anything. And of course there's always the when things, you know, life comes along and throws a wrench into a plan, whether it's, you know, death, disability, divorce, all those types of things. So college is an important piece. However, what I have also discovered is most families are not going to say, we didn't plan well, college is canceled.
Ah,
they're going to figure out how to do it. Either they're going to do it a painful way or they're going to plan it well. But no matter what, they're just not going to cancel it like we might a vacation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make good plans for spring break, so I guess we're not going anywhere this spring break. That's not how we solve college. It's in a lot of cases, we take on a bunch of loans that we don't really understand. And that's where we hear the stories about, you know, kids and or parents being buried in debt.
Yeah, I think it was last week or the week before on the show, we were talking about college planning. We talk about loans. And one of the little gotchas that a lot of people don't know about college loans is that it's one of the few, you could tell everybody, it's one of the few items that when you borrow are not exempt from or cannot be extinguished through bankruptcy.
Correct. Right. And again, that's on purpose. Otherwise, banks would underwrite the loans and say, okay, well, should we loan money to this student who has no credit history, has no job, has no education? You know, what kind of interest rate would they have to charge if there was a fair market rate that could be discharged in bankruptcy? Otherwise, everybody would borrow a bunch of money for college, file bankruptcy, you know, right after graduation, and then pick up their life from there. You know, that doesn't work. So in the end, they made the rules for the student loan such that they cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. Now, and then the government got involved bank a lot of the time and the interest rates vary. And, you know, so it starts out with a basic program and then things evolve and it gets more and more challenging. Yeah,
and then the government comes, we're the government, we're here to help. Right.
Exactly.
But let me ask you this, because this is something that's been bugging me for a long time. It seems that over the last, I don't know, pick your time, decade, two decades, whatever it is, you know, time. It seems like because of the ease of getting college loans and the relatively low cost that it was, as far as interest and all the parameters set forth, and then the pushing people that you have to go to college no matter what, right? You can't just have a skill. You have to go to college. It seems like the combination of all of this led to a ridiculous amount of increase in the cost of college itself, because they knew, we'll just get a loan. I mean, we're not looking at it. It's kind of like buying a car. Are you buying a car that's $50,000 or are you buying a car that's $320 a month? And right. I think that's what turned out, that people didn't care anymore. They were being convinced, and then colleges went off the rails. Is this something you've seen?
Yeah. And to be fair, it's not entirely the college's fault. They have a lot of challenges themselves, such as, I mean, name any other business that has to babysit their customers 24/7 and keep them safe from drugs and drinking and all the other things that we put on a college. We expect them to provide, you know, health services, mental health services, keep track of where the kids are and keep them safe from the drinking and the, you know, the tough situations, et cetera, et cetera. But then that drives the cost up.
Yeah.
But in reality, that's what parents are demanding. And we've also heard the stories, right, of the colleges building these amenities. Well, why are they building the amenities? Because people won't go to the college if you don't have the amenities.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently that's what they need to do, right? Nobody says, well, I'm not going there, it's too expensive, I'm going to go over here where the dorms suck.
Yeah.
That way I can save some money.
Yeah. I'm not going to pitch a tent somewhere and that'll be the best and use just only used books and who needs new clothes, you know? I get it.
Right.
I get it.
And then another big factor that most people, you know, don't realize is that higher education as a industry, you know, less than half the students today are the kids that roll out of high school and go on to college. The other half are returning students and grad level students and adult learners of various sorts and tech colleges and all kinds of different forms of education. So I think the college for everyone that the politicians put out there was probably one of the most damaging things that they could have done, because, you know, college isn't for everyone and it shouldn't be for everyone. College for some or college for most, maybe, but not everyone. And I think that's, what, again, another trap that families have to deal with. Of there's many careers where you're going to need an education. There's many careers where the education is not necessarily a four-year degree. It's some other degree, some other school. And then ultimately there's the school of hard knocks, and that might be the right path for some.
But the funny thing, Brad, is that, you know, four-year college, your liberal arts degree, your basic degree is an education, right? It's not a skill. Whereas you can go somewhere and learn, whether it's via a specialty program, let's say a two-year specialty program as an example, which if you think about it for a second, well, 2 years versus 4 years, a four-year college degree and getting little bits of all these different things like medieval art, right? And right. Versus a two-year program in, I'm just picking something out of the blue here, welding. I don't know if that's really 2 years, but a two-year program in welding, by the time you're done, you're pretty much doing, you got it. You got a grip on this whole thing. So it's really unfortunate that this whole idea that came in that just only a four-year college is for every single job out there and it's required.
Right. Absolutely. And I think you can take that one step further, but there's training programs that are, you know, on the job and apprentice. There's training programs that are 2 year degrees, but there's also training programs that are 4 year degrees, 6 year degrees, and 8 year degrees. I mean, in essence, medical school, they're teaching you how to be a doctor.
Right.
And that's, they don't do a lot of medieval philosophy and all that other stuff. They are teaching you a skill set that you can go out and execute on the job.
Right.
But, you know, if you want to sell MRI machines or you want to run a small business, what degree do you need?
Yep. There is no.
It's a tough call. You know, you don't need any degree. Some degrees might be helpful, but, you know, so there is that where, you know, I advise families and I've heard, I didn't invent this. I heard it somewhere, but, you know, figure out what you want to be when you grow up and then how many different paths are there to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to be a rock star musician, do you need to go to college? Do you need to go study guitar for 4 years at a university and get a liberal arts degree of some sort? Probably not. Matter of fact, if you look at most rock stars, that's not how they do it.
Most of them did not go to Juilliard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, but that path might get you into the symphony or something like that, or more likely to get you into the symphony. I'm sure there's plenty of cases where musicians took many different paths to get to where they were.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you look at an elementary ed teacher.
Yes.
They all have an elementary ed degree just about.
Yep.
Although with the shortages now, I think some school districts are trying to bend the rules and come up with ways to get more teachers in the classroom.
Yeah.
But in general, that has always been the path.
Of course.
You go get the degree and then
figure it out.
And it was also pretty specific too. If you have that degree, then you pretty much knew what you were going to do.
Yeah. Now it's like get a degree and then just find out what you want to do after the fact. It's almost a rite of passage. You're required to have that degree. That's where it's kind of gone a little bit, I think, twisty from what I can see.
Right.
But
and there's this ongoing debate around, well, if I could go pass the bar test, can I just become a lawyer and skip all that school?
Yeah.
Or if I can pass the, you know, medical exams, can I become a doctor? And that's the way it used to work. But now, you know, again, for safety reasons and also potentially to protect the high paying jobs from being inundated, you know, there's a little bit of protecting and keeping out so that it stays a valuable degree. As well, but yeah, so there's all kinds of politics involved but that's kind of the lay of the land. What I'm dealing with most of the time was that we've got a 17-year-old and we're trying to figure this all out. And yes, there's a lot of philosophical questions around, is it worth it and all that kind of stuff, but it's go time right now. It doesn't really matter where education is going long term. In the short term, we have to decide which college we're going to in the next, year or so, and we have to figure out how to pay for it, and we have to understand need-based aid and merit aid, and what our student needs to figure out what they want to be when they grow up, and parents need to help guide the process. And
there's no pause button on getting closer to the college age. Not like let's put this on pause and we'll come back to it.
Right. Well, absolutely. With the exception now, gap year is becoming much more popular. I don't think that's a good way to solve the fact that parents didn't plan well, but it might be a good way to solve the student can't lay out a particular path, maybe a gap year is appropriate. And it's becoming more accepted now, where in the past, you know, the advice was against it because you didn't want to slow down your academic momentum. Now some, you know, many colleges pretty much accept a gap year as normal, and they're not going to hold it against you.
That's pretty fascinating. Let's because that was something that was very questionable for a long time, you know, and then because the concern is that the person's going to be like, I don't want to go back to that again. Look how much fun it is out here.
Yep.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's still real, of course, is. And again, I've seen, you know, kids with, they, you know, want the year off just because of academic burnout, or they work so hard in high school, they want to take a year off, or. But and we saw a lot during COVID where kids were saying, well, I don't really want to go to that expensive school and study from my dorm room online. I'm going to take a gap year.
Yeah, that was an interesting change of a sharp turn in the fork in the road, actually, of college.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to talk about, you know, how people that are listening can optimize. How could they, well, first of all, where they should start, but what are some of the best strategies? Hang on a second. We're just going to. We're going to pause for a moment and let's just take a quick break. And we come back again, some strategies and where to be like, where do we, so people, here's the point. I think people get very frustrated. You probably see this, right? People get very frustrated. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do and they just shut down, but there are some ways to start doing this. So I'm going to ask you that right over the top of the break. Hang on. And yes, we're talking about our good friends at Interactive Brokers, because you don't have to wait for the market to open anymore. Did you know that? With around-the-clock trading, you could trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs. In fact, you could also trade U.S. equity index options and even U.S. Treasury bonds. Around-the-clock trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and capture more market opportunities. This flexibility, well, it basically allows you to trade on your timetable and invest during local market hours or whenever it's convenient for you. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Learn more at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. So Brad Baldwin, taming the high cost of college. We've been talking about this whole idea of, you know, what it's all about, where you lead up to, some of the hurdles. Where do people begin? Where should they begin?
Right. So if you think about college planning in general, there's a lot of specific tactics and strategies. The challenge is there's so many and only a few of them apply in any particular situation. You know, for example, if I shift this money that is in this account that counts against me into this account over here that doesn't count against me, I will qualify for more financial aid.
Uh-huh.
You know, sometimes that, you know, a lot of times that's true, or sometimes you'll qualify for more, but you just won't get more. So you really need to understand, you know, when to pull what strategies and what to do. There's obviously tax breaks that are associated with paying for college or saving for college, et cetera, et cetera. If you're in higher tax brackets and are paying a lot of taxes, those strategies can look pretty good. But if you already don't pay taxes, then, you know, those strategies aren't as appealing. So that's, I think, the challenge is there literally are hundreds, and for each family, you know, there's 5 or 10 that are the best. You know, there's scholarships as an example. If you look at Stanford, they're crazy expensive. They're $90,000 plus per year. Mm. A lot of people say,
undergrad at Stanford is $90,000 a year?
That's correct.
$90,000, or what are we talking about here?
Yeah, $90,000 per year.
For Stanford? Really?
Right. And again, to be fair, that's total cost of attendance, which is tuition, room and board, books, fees, beer and pizza. That's what a typical student spends in a year.
Okay.
And as you get involved in college planning, that's a fair way to make comparisons, right? As you look at the total cost of attendance at 5 or 6 schools, and Stanford is $90,000. And the average state school is about $28,000. The average private school is about $60,000. You know, some private schools are $60,000, some are $70,000, some are $90,000. That's, you know. Now, a lot of people say, well, we can't afford to go to Stanford. And I would argue that many, many people can afford to go to Stanford, because Stanford has released a program that essentially says if your income is under $100,000 per year, then Stanford will be free. They will cover all of room and board, and they will cover all of tuition. So that would be the low-cost option for most families.
Yeah. Well, assuming
you challenge is you got to get accepted to Stanford.
Right.
Which means you need an academic rock star. But again, don't cross a school off the list because of what's of the published prices of colleges.
So it's like a list price, but yet there's a there's an inside right. price.
Exactly. It's like when we bought cars 5 and 10 years ago. I mean, the car game has changed quite a bit too, but there was a time when everybody knew list price was high and they were going to pay something less. They just weren't exactly sure how much less. Well, when it comes to college, it's the same thing. The list price is high and you, at most of the time, you'll pay something less, unless maybe the low-cost state schools might be the exception to that. But a typical private school, you're going to pay less, or at least could pay less at the right schools. And those discounts can be, you know, 40%, 60%. You know, Stanford example, 100%.
Now, how do you feel about that, Brad? How do you feel about that the average person, now this is good for your business, so let's just get that straight. This is good for somebody in the college planning business, right? So, but seriously though, how do you feel about the average person having such a difficult time trying to weave through and understand this in a time that's very stressful? I mean, it seems like a disservice to the average person.
Well, in some ways it is, but again, it just has kind of evolved to where it is. But the whole concept of need-based aid as an example, right? College is expensive, so we're going to put this program together that will help people that don't have enough to be able to reasonably afford college. So they put together some grants and some preferred loans and that kind of stuff as part of the federal program or a state program. But now they have to define, well, what does it take to be a needy family? If your income is $75,000, do you qualify or is it $50,000?
Yeah.
Or what if you have a big family or a small family? So then when they start getting into the details, all of a sudden they build this system, kind of like the way taxes evolved, the way healthcare has evolved over the years, where they built a system and then they keep bolting stuff onto the system, right? So originally, the federal government offered some programs, and then they modified them, and then they added more. And now a lot of states are getting involved as well, because the states run the state schools, and they realize those are getting expensive. So now they've made decisions. We could raise the price of the school and then provide more help to families that need it. And then we get, the net revenue is still positive that way because people that can't afford it will pay for it, and people that can't afford it will help. Versus dropping the price for everybody across the board. Is that fair? I don't know.
I don't know.
It's what some have chosen to do.
Yeah.
It's never going to be fair because there's too many ways to define fair.
So let's talk about, let's reel this back for a second. I'm a parent, and obviously this is an open-ended question because you may be starting planning for college later, earlier. I mean, many people are listening are in all sorts of different stages. But let's take the optimal, right? Let's take the optimal. Yeah, where is the optimal point when someone should begin planning for college education costs?
Right. So, what I would call late stage planning would start freshman sophomore year of high school. Now, late stage versus early stage. So, early stage planning is, hey, I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old in college someday, and Brad just told me how crazy expensive it is. So we're going to start saving, putting some money aside, whatever it might be. And that's all good, right? But that's early stage planning. You're not really visiting colleges. You don't expect your student to pick a major or a career or anything like that. Late stage is when you switch from saving and investing to going up the track to figuring out the next step. So how does that work? Once you switch to high school, now we're visiting, we're trying to figure out need-based aid, merit aid, all the different programs. And a lot of times it's kind of the parents that have to do some of the heavy lifting around that. And you can do that, say sophomore year, maybe freshman year, where you start, again, you don't have to do it all at once, but start understanding, will we qualify for need-based aid? Will we qualify for merit aid? Maybe up until this point, you put $100 a month into some savings somewhere. What did that grow to? Is it going to be enough? Are we thinking 2-year school, four-year school? Are we thinking a private school at 90, a private school at 60? What kind of scholarships are we going to get? All that type of stuff. So when you get into the planning, there's kind of a two-step process. What is the net price of college going to be? This college lists at 60, but after scholarships and the other grants and free money, the net cost is 30. And then somehow we have to pay $30,000 a year. Well, we happen to have $100,000 saved, so we're good. We're close.
Close, yep.
Or we happen to have nothing saved, and now should we jump, you know, do we need to turn on $2,000 a month towards college? And that's, you know, when I'm working with families, that's kind of the big picture stuff that we're talking about of, well, based on what our goals are, you have three kids that are looking at this type of college, and right now you've got, you know, it's going to take this $50,000 you've already saved. Plus, we're going to steal this $50,000 over here that you saved for other things, but we're going to repurpose it to college. And then on top of that, we need $1,000 a month. Might be something that happens with a typical middle income family with a few kids.
Right.
And sometimes it's, wow, we have this big pile of money, but let's figure out how we can spend it efficiently so that that's all we need. Because if you, you know, you choose the most expensive school, it's not enough. But if we can find something that's reasonable, you know, you should have enough and maybe a little left over for grad school.
So are there specific strategies that you think are better than others when looking at saving and paying for college?
Mostly I think it's just do it.
That's that's simple, by the way, Brad, but that's the point, isn't it?
Exactly.
No, seriously, right? Seriously. That's the point.
Right. Exactly. Right. That's the thought, right? Is if, you know, if your family philosophy is we value education and we'd love for our kids to, you know, have a lot of options and not come out with a lot of debt, and that's important to us. Well, by definition, you're saying education, you know, the allocation of your resources to education needs to be higher than if you said, you know, we don't care about it that much, which means by definition, you need a smaller house or less cars or less vacations, you know, all things being equal. Now, if you can, you know, what I enjoy about what I do is if you optimize everything you do, you can do a little more. You know, if you find the way to keep your vehicle costs lower, then you have more for college. If you find a way to keep your college lower, then you have more for retirement, so forth and so on. So trying to be efficient, I think, is important, but also just the general philosophy of, okay, well, if we're going to do it, then it's going to be at the expense of something.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting because it's a balancing act, right? It's how much do I either, first of all, I could say college is a must for my children. That doesn't mean I necessarily need to pay for that, by the way, but college is a must. I will help out up to a certain point and maybe we'll roll in some loans into that at all. But what's interesting is over the last 25, 30 years, 40 years, we know that the life expectancy of people is longer. It's getting longer. That's because of medicines. It's because of lifestyle. It's because of knowledge, all the things, right? It used to be, you know, people would be, I don't know, 75 years old and that would be it. Now it's like 90. Point is that balancing act with paying that giant chunk of money potentially for college in the midst of your operating years of income generation, whereas that is being put into a college fund rather than a retirement fund, is a very important decision to make, especially with us all living longer, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's where, you know, again, for most families, you know, let me give you an example. So I had a dad come to me a few years ago. His daughter was very talented, wanted to go to the Tisch Performing Arts Center in New York at New York University. And we started running the numbers and she did great. She got some fantastic scholarships. So the net cost of college was $35,000 at that school. But then he started doing the math and saying, well, $35,000 times 4 years, that's $140,000 times four kids.
Ouch.
Wow, that's a big number.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Can I? Should I? How does that work? Well, So then we did some general financial planning. And what we discovered was he was reasonably successful. He had decent cash flow and he was had saved into his retirement, most of his career. So he had a pretty decent nest egg. And we talked about it. And essentially, basic math said, well, you could retire at 62 based on, what's going on in your retirement. If we redirect some of your cash flow into college for the next few years so that you can make this happen, well, then you probably can't retire till 65 or 66. And that was great news for him because he's like, well, I don't really want to retire anyway. I enjoy what I do. I probably went retiring till, 65, 70. If I can, if I'm still healthy and everything's good, then, and he was happy to pay for college.
Yeah.
But he was just worried that how that all would fit together. And that's where, good planning, broad based planning of makes sense. And then we were able to drill down and get into some of the tactics and say, all right, well, now if we shift this over here and do this instead of that and shift this, we'll save a few thousand in taxes. And if we do this instead of that, we'll save a few thousand more in financial aid. And we optimized it. And then we did the same thing with his retirement. Let's get your retirement investments a little more efficient so that more of it, you keep more of it for your own, for yourself instead of paying a lot in fees and so forth and so on.
So there's a lot of things that you said there that a lot of people, would love to do, right? They'd love to pay. A lot of people would love to pay. Hey, I'm paying for college. And if it was something reasonable, right? And people are getting a little bit more nervous, but they also don't know about other things that are out there. For example, scholarships, financial aid. The financial aid side of things, when we're talking about government programs, it's very complicated, isn't it?
It is, right. So I've created the Scholarship Guide for Busy Parents, where we talk about that. Because in general, the number one provider of scholarships, like $60 billion per year, is the colleges themselves. But that's a little bit of smoke and mirrors because a lot of those scholarships really are just tuition discounts. Our tuition is $60,000, but for you, we'll give you a $30,000 scholarship. Are they giving you money and then taking it back? No, they're just giving you a discount. It's like a coupon at Kohl's, right? Where that $60 t-shirt turns out to be $12 if you play the game. Or you go to Walmart and you just buy the t-shirt for $12. Right. So that's kind of the difference between a state school and a public school, or excuse me, a public school and a private school in some instances, right? State schools tend to not play the games as much. They start at a lower price, though. And then the catch 22 there is some of the high end schools, the Stanford school that we mentioned earlier, they don't offer any merit aid. So if your income is, say, $500,000 or $1 million, you're going to pay full price at Stanford because they're not going to offer your student a merit scholarship. They're not going to say you have great grades. Here's $30,000 off. Essentially, you have to have great grades to be accepted. And then if you need aid, they'll provide it. Now, that same student could apply to many, many other colleges where they'd say, wow, you're a really strong student. Here's a merit scholarship for $20,000 off or $40,000 off. And the net cost, instead of Stanford being net 90 because you don't get any discounts at all, you go to a different school that, net 50 or net 40. And of course, a student that's that strong could also be the presidential scholar at a particular school where they pay zero, right? There's many schools out there where the top 5 or 10 kids don't pay anything at all because they're the presidential scholar, or maybe there's another name for it at many schools because it's named after somebody that put up the $5 million to cover that tuition for all those students, in perpetuity. So every year they have 5 kids that get a full scholarship because of some wealthy donor. And you could be that kid.
And what's interesting is
you don't need to understand it.
There also needs to be some, I think you have to pause and think about also, what are the opportunities on the other side? If I go to Stanford, is it going to give me automatic entree into this hedge fund or this law firm? If I go to law school, or make it easier on me to go to law school. If I go to Stanford, pay the full ride because everybody knows what the story is, right? It's somebody who's smart and can afford it. That's the point. But how do you, so there's all sorts of financial aid. Do you find that a lot of people don't want to be bothered with the financial aid game and just say screw it and they're leaving a lot of money on the table?
I wouldn't say that they don't want to be bothered with it. Where we see that would be the scholarships, right? So you go back to, it makes perfect sense to take all the scholarships you can get from the colleges that you're applying to. And there's a very limited places to look, right? You work with the colleges and you find them. Whereas if you have a black belt in judo, is there a scholarship out there? There's probably a few. How do you find them? It's a lot of work. Well, what about if I have I'm Irish Lithuanian? Is there a scholarship for that? I don't know. And you'd have to go and search. And there are lots of scholarships for lots of things. And if your student is, you know, strong academically, you're more likely to win the scholarships. If your student is very unique, right? But occasionally, you know, parents will come to me and say, "Well, here's my kid's profile. They get A's and B's mostly, and you know, they try hard sometimes, but not every time. They are on the football team, but I don't think they've ever started. They say they're in French club, but I've never seen them go. And they're pretty good at Xbox. And show me the scholarships for my kid." And it's like, well, there are scholarships for that kid. The challenge is there's also a million kids qualified for those scholarships. Mm-hmm. Because, again, there's nothing unique about that. And that's where some families get frustrated. You know, the average kid that participates in band and goes out for a couple sports, you know, they don't have a lot of uniqueness compared to the kid that started a charity when he was 7 and raised $100,000 for cancer. Or, you know, again, as an academic rock star or
an athlete.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Or exactly a mathlete or built a robot or discovered something new or all those different things. Right. The kids that do well at the national science fair, they've got something to talk about, write about and compete with. The kids that showed up for science class, well, that's everybody. So that's, you know, so when kids are unique, there's an opportunity. When kids aren't as unique, you know, less of an opportunity, unfortunately.
So you talk about that academic stuff, right? The academic requirements and all that. And one of the things that recently was the news that there's a change in the, I don't know, the importance in college testing, ACT, SATs. Mm-hmm. Some colleges are now playing around with not, and then they turned it around and said so they said no, it's not required because a lot of people in a certain demographic don't test well, and yes. We don't, and that's a problem. I'm thinking to myself, because what do I know? Isn't the whole point of going to school is learning and then testing? Isn't that the point? Is learning, mm-hmm. and then being able to regurgitate that out in a way when someone asks? Isn't that the way of training for business, training for, I don't know, whatever particular profession you're in? You have to know something's going to happen. You're a doctor. There's a vein that bursts. You're going to have to tie it off and make sure you put in, I don't know, some plasma or something, whatever the response is, mm-hmm. right? You are, I don't know, you're a pilot and you're flying and you got to know, you got to pull up, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to check, you got to write, you got to, that's the whole mm-hmm. point, is to get someone acclimated to that. You got to know that they can actually handle that. And many of these schools went to no testing, and then they're turning it full circle, aren't they now, going back to testing? What right. do you feel about that?
Right. Well, so again, no testing has been around for a long time. When COVID hit, it got accelerated a lot. Essentially, it was nearly impossible for about a year for any student to take a test anywhere because the test locations were closing and, you know, reopening and then closing and so forth and so on. So it was nearly impossible to take a test. So the colleges had no choice but to say, we'll be test optional, or, you know, 80% of the students out there no longer can be our customer, which was, you know, very self-defeating. So they had no choice. Some realized that it didn't matter if they had testing or not. They felt they still got the similar quality of student. Other colleges are of the opinion that testing is an important indicator for what they're looking for or how to determine if they're getting so it's a political decision, it's a marketing decision, and it's an academic decision. Where if we can be test optional, there's a lot of bright kids that, you know, don't do well on tests,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. but they're good students still. And that could be a focus for a particular college and say, well, we'll take those kids that have fantastic grades and everything else is good. They just struggle with testing. So will be test optional, and then we won't even see the test. It'll give those kids some confidence to apply to us, and then we'll take that group. Other schools are like, no, you know, because the opposite could be true, right? For some reason, my grades aren't that good, but I'm a bright kid and I can do really well on the tests. I deserve a chance because I, you know, I do know this stuff. I just didn't demonstrate it well on my grades.
That's a hard thing to bridge.
Right, exactly. So what's fair? There is no fair. There's just different. You know, so when the high end schools, the Stanfords and Yales of the world, who often said, you know, often you know the requirements were really good test scores and really good grades and everything else. As soon as they said we're test optional, well, there's a whole new batch of people that were able to apply because they didn't have good test scores, but it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So it changed who they accepted potentially, but the people that they accepted were probably just as deserving as the kids with the good test scores that lost a spot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But again, it was just different. It's not more fair or less fair to include it or not include it. So there's a lot of, you know, opinions around that. And it circles back around too of the, are you trying to learn how to learn? Are you trying to learn, you know, a broad, you know, the liberal arts concept of, well, just learn how to learn and learn how to write well and learn how to analyze data and learn how to do that. And then when you go out and you're in the real world, you'll transfer those skills to whatever job you have.
Mm.
Or again, what I'm learning in college is job training, right? When you get hired as a nurse, they expect you to know how to do nursing stuff.
That'd be good.
When you get hired as an MRI salesman, most of the time they don't expect you to know much about MRI machines because there's no classes on MRI machines at most colleges.
Right. There's no track. There's no MRI salesperson track.
Right. Therefore, they know they're going to have to take somebody that has sales capability indicators, whatever they think those are, and train them on the job.
Right.
And that's the reality of it, yeah. Right? And as adults, we know that, right? We did something in school. Then we got 5 years experience, and all of a sudden, most of the time, what we did in school didn't matter. The 5 years experience is what matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth and so on. But, you know, so, and again, most people, when you talk to them, have perhaps a hard left or a hard right turn in their career path. I went to school for nursing. I practiced as a nurse for a few years.
Yeah.
Then I got a job in sales, and I was selling medical stuff.
Yeah.
But then my sales skills allowed me to go move off and sell this stuff that has nothing to do with medical or nursing. Or did I waste my time getting a nursing degree? No, it led me to the path I'm on. And I like the path I'm on, even though nursing was just one stop along the way.
So let's, I mean,
that's the reality for lots of people.
Let's just recap here. First of all, start early is a best is one of the better ideas.
Yes.
Understand that there are options and there are different ways to pay. There are scholarships. There is financial aid. There are ways in which you can do this in a tax efficient manner. There are different plans. There are programs from the government. There are tax deferred issues. There's a lot of different ways to skin this cat, so to speak. Right.
Right. And oftentimes you're going to use multiples of those. It's going to be some loans, some scholarships, you know, some saving and investing, some of this, some of that, all piled together in a unique way for your situation.
And then after college is over, the good news is that maybe you have a couple more things, but then you don't have to pay for your kids anymore. Like, for example, me, who seemingly can't get my kids off of the cell phone plan. Now, do you have any advice for that?
If you just turn them off?
Yeah, that's just me.
They will figure it out.
Yeah, I guess so. It's like, but it's cheaper when it comes on your plan because you get the multi-plan. I'm like, wait. How is it cheaper? It costs me more. How does that work? Like, you get a multi phone number discount. I'm like, yeah, but okay. It's fine.
Right.
Brad Baldwich, Taming the High Cost of College, is a podcast, Taming the High Cost of College. You go to tamingthehighcostofcollege.com, bradbaldridge.com. We'll have all the information in the show notes for this episode, which is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Go over to disciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 878. Brad, it's 878 episodes already. It's a lot of time in this.
Wow.
Yep, back it from is. 07. And check it out. We'll have more information on how to get in touch with Brad. Brad, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for the insights today on college, which is an area that I don't think is talked about enough, but it's a big chunk of money that comes into play throughout our lifetimes.
Absolutely.
So thanks so much. I'll see you soon.
Yep. Thank you.
That's going to end it for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Make sure to stay tuned because we're going to have the keeper of the keeping information, the keeper of the stuff, the guy that oversees it all, Howard Silverblatt from S&P Global Dow Jones Industrial Indices. So I've had him on before. Fascinating guy. Been a friend for many, many years. And he's going to bring us all the stuff that we need to know about what's going on with earnings season, how it's playing out, what the expectations are. And I got some questions to ask him about how it all shakes out when it comes to the big companies and the little companies. So make sure to get ready for that in the next episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Get over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out all the things that are offered you and exactly how we can help you manage your money so you can have a financially secure future. Thanks so much for joining me this week and every week. Have a good one. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.